Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Tuesday morning. It's August 18th. Currently 62 degrees here in Old Town Park City, 62 degrees as well in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Tuesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back. As we look at your forecast for your Tuesday, look for a mixture of clouds and sunshine. A weak disturbance moving by may provide just a slight chance of a pop-up shower or storm. That's primarily going to be for the mountains east of I-15. We'll keep that chance at about a 20% or less. As we make our way into your Wednesday, we're looking at partly sunny skies. Temperatures on the hot side will be in the mid-80s for us in Park City. We're looking at high temperatures climbing into the lower 90s in the Heber Valley. As we move into your Thursday, we're looking at partly cloudy skies, and I think the core of the heat will be on top of us as we go into your Thursday. So look for high temperatures in Park City to climb into the upper 80s to near 90 degrees. We'll see those high temperatures in the mid-90s in the Heber Valley. Now, as we go into your Thursday, there's going to be just an uptick in moisture, just enough to potentially give us that slight chance of a pop-up storm across the area once again. Now, as we go into your Friday, we're going to add in a slightly better chance of those pop-up storms in the afternoon. Before that, it looks to get hot. Highs in the upper 80s to near 90 in Park City, and we'll be in the mid-90s again in the Heber Valley. Moving into the weekend, well, make sure you take the rain gear with you wherever you may be going. It's not going to be a washout by any means, but we will have both Saturday and Sunday daily chances of those scattered showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon. A pretty good chance of seeing some of that moisture moving through. That'll help lower the temperatures a little bit. Highs in the low 80s for your Saturday and Sunday in Park City. We'll see those highs only in the upper 80s for us in the Heber Valley. Now, as we head into early next week, we'll keep that chance of some of those isolated pop-up storms in the afternoon for your Monday, and we'll see those temperatures, again, a little cooler, upper 70s in Park City with highs only in the mid-80s in the Heber Valley. So the heat is on over the next few days, but we will cool it down with that rain chance increasing for the weekend. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
8:08 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Thanks for tuning in. Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour, I'll be checking in with Wasatch County Manager Justin Graybaugh, taking a look at Wednesday's county council meeting agenda. Film director of the feature documentary Oshima, Kenji Tsukamoto, has details on his film that's screening in Park City on Thursday at the Jim Santee Auditorium. And from Recycle Utah, Executive Director Andy Heck in with the latest from the Recycling Center and details on this weekend's fundraiser. Then stay tuned for This Green Earth. Today's guests include chemical biologist, conservation leader, Dr. Rosa Vasquez Espinoza, talking about her work protecting wild pollinators and the Amazon. Then Casey Lindstrom, Utah Project Manager for Wildlands Network, shares more about the organization and the policy and project initiatives created to study, restore, and maintain large-scale habitat connectivity in the West. All of that coming up on This Green Earth, heard, of course, every Tuesday from 9 to 10. Right now, it's 8:09. Well, taking a look now at some local news, two major water providers for Summit and Wasatch counties are proposing tax increases this year. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports Summit County will be hit hardest despite its small population.
The government boards in charge of selling water to local water companies in Summit and Wasatch counties have scheduled truth and taxation hearings at the end of August. Truth in taxation is the public process required under Utah law to raise property taxes. The Central Utah Water Conservancy District is proposing a 1.6% increase across Salt Lake, Utah, Juab, Duchesne, Uinta, Summit, and Wasatch counties. The Weber Basin Water Conservancy District is proposing an almost 7% property tax increase, split between Box Elder, Davis, Weber, Morgan, and Summit counties. The water districts tax all property owners at the same rate, so Wasatch and Summit counties, where property values are high, pay more per person than the other localities. That's the basis of David Darcy's criticism for the Weber Basin District. The Camas resident, who sits on a number of local government boards, spoke out at Wednesday's Summit County Council meeting.
So they've come up with two proposed uses, $1 million for conservation efforts, like the rebate programs, like turf, taking out your turf, or $100 for low-flow toilets, and also $738,000 to go towards the original Bureau of Reclamation project that was done in 1955, you know, the big aqueducts down in Layton and Clearfield and in Davis County.
Darcy predicts the money for incentives will be spent downstream as well, since most people live along the Wasatch Front. He says Summit County only accounts for 5% of the Weber Basin's population. It's the county with the highest median income, but it also has large income disparities, particularly between the Park City area and rural East Side.
We are being used as the golden pig or the patsy, paying for 37% of the property taxes and seeing nothing spent in this county that benefits county residents. At this point, I'd be happy for a couple of gardening classes up here in Colville or something, something to show for the $10 million that we're spending each year that we're sending down to Layton each year.
If the tax increase goes through, the Weber Basin Water District would be collecting an additional $642,000 from Summit County annually. That's more than it would collect from Davis or Weber counties, which have between 6 and 9 times as many people. The Weber Basin public hearing is at 6:30 p.m. August 24th at district headquarters in Layton, and residents can attend virtually as well. The Central Utah Water District only includes a sliver of Summit County in Francis and Woodland. It would still collect an extra $120,000 from Wasatch County landowners, but the bulk of its increase would come from Utah County paying more than $500,000 and Salt Lake County paying more than $1 million. Central Utah has planned 3 hearings, the first in Roosevelt, August 24th. The other two will be on the 25th and August 26th at district headquarters in Orem. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
News time coming up on 8:14. Good morning. The Wasatch County Council meets in regular session Wednesday at 4 p.m. And on the phone with a preview of the meeting, I have County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start with the Sitla property. The County Council recently spoke with the developer of Wasatch Heightlands, which is a preliminary municipality in its early stages. This discussion, however, was actually about an adjacent piece of property. It's the Sitla, or the State Institutional Trust Lands property. Can you explain what's going on here?
Yeah, so it is the same developer working on both properties, but for the last few years, Wasatch County and Heber City have been involved in discussions with the developer about the fate of some of this property. Right now, most of the property is zoned Wasatch County's Preservation 160 zone, which means it's intended for preservation of, you know, watersheds and animal areas and other things like that. But there has been a request to upzone these things pretty significantly. So the preliminary municipality is the way that they are looking to address the properties that aren't owned by the state. And over the last year and a half or so, we've worked with the developer on negotiating on specifically, like you said, the Sitla piece, which is about 720 acres located on the south side, just north of Little Pole Road, or kind of along Little Pole Road.
Yeah, so since this is Sitla property, how much power does the county have over development here?
I think, you know, we talked a little bit about this during the public meeting, that there is an ambiguous ability for Sitla to preempt local authority. We don't feel like that's carte blanche, that they could just do whatever they want and sell it to a private third party. So I think if there was a state entity that was developing it for their own use, the county would have less say than if it was something that's intended to be sold to the public. So that's why I think we feel like overall, Wasatch County does have some ability to push back against it, and why the county council did.
Yeah. So, I mean, the way that Sitla works, right, I mean, it owns all this property, and it kind of acquired it at statehood, and it does have the authority, the board, to sell off property for development as a way to build up funding for education?
Yeah, so Sitla exists to utilize these properties for the benefit of our state education system. And they have sold many properties over their history. I believe we found the title from this property. Actually, it was acquired in like 1963 or something like that. And so their goal is to maximize the profit off of these properties for the benefit of that education system. They do that in a number of ways. Some of it is development. They actually have sold other properties to the DNR to use as wildlife management areas or other things like that. And ultimately, they're just looking for a way to monetize it to fulfill the purpose of their entity.
All right. So the developer is proposing 144 units of density on the land. What kind of development is being proposed? And maybe talk about some of the council's biggest concerns here.
Yeah, this would be the 144 units was kind of a goal that they were aiming for that averages out to 5 acres per unit. And this is more dense, obviously, than what is currently there. I think it's about 8 units that would be entitled under the existing zoning. And that significant change from 8 to 144 is, I think, the biggest issue that the council was wrestling with. You know, we had a subcommittee kind of negotiating with them, and I think we tried to get as far as we could that negotiation, but ultimately ended up bringing it back to the whole council, who rejected it.
Yeah. So what's next for the property?
What we heard from the council was, we'd like to approach CITLA about some alternatives. I think that could be other very low density development that would have much less impact. You know, if it was something like an M20 zone, which is a piece of this is already 20 acre zoning, a very small piece, that would be somewhere in the range of 30 units. And maybe that is something that we could get CITLA to buy off on. I think the other is we wouldn't be opposed to if the DNR wanted to purchase this land, or if we could facilitate that in some way, if there's other ways that we could preserve it. One of the advantages of our M20 and P160 zones is you can do clustered development. You can put all those units down at the bottom, do a very affordable development that, while it doesn't generate as much profit as, you know, 144 units or more, it can still be a profitable development, and we can preserve the majority of the property.
Mm-hmm. But doesn't that kind of go against CITLA's purpose to monetize the maximum profit for these state lands?
Well, I think that's kind of where we're at, though, is we feel like 144 is not a feasible way to monetize it. So if you have that in your mind and think, well, we need to get, you know, X million of dollars because it's going to have 144 units on it, I think the county council just said, well, no, that's not going to happen. We're not interested in that. So then the question becomes, well, if it's not that, then what? And that's where we'd like to propose, you know, there are other solutions that maybe don't generate as much profit, but are still profitable and still fulfill the purpose of MIDA, or not MIDA, CITLA.
Okay. Just a few hours after that discussion, Wasatch County leaders met with Summit County to council to discuss preliminary municipalities. What were your biggest takeaways from that conversation?
That there is a lot of united concern about this particular development practice. So Wasatch County, we have on our agenda this week, actually, the resolution opposing that. And we're excited to work with both Summit County, as well as they encourage us to reach out to Morgan County. We're reaching out to Grand County as well, where there is a preliminary municipality. And we think there are other counties across the state who would join us in kind of calling for the state to reform this law that we think is a really problematic development practice.
Yeah. So it sounds like you do have some forces willing to join you, huh?
Yeah, and I think that there is strength in numbers. You know, we've seen that as the public gets engaged and gives that feedback to legislators, I think we can be successful in pushing back on these things that are maybe unsustainable in their approach.
So does the county council then intend to vote on some sort of resolution to that effect at its meeting tomorrow?
Yes. So we have prepared a draft resolution that would call for the state to fully repeal it would be from the 2024 general session, SB 258. You know, whether fully repeal it or make significant changes to it, we'd like to be involved in seeing how we can make this work better for our community.
Okay, and you're hoping that the other counties involved would do the same?
Yes. Yeah, we're hoping really as many counties as would be willing would join on and pass something similar.
All right. Summit and Wasatch counties have started meeting within the past couple of years. Of course, the Camas Gun Club Road was another issue you worked on recently together. What changed the relationship, do you think?
You know, I think when I first came to the county in 2019, we had a joint meeting, and that's when we talked about some of the development that's happening in the north part of our county, immediately adjacent to Summit County. And I think there was this maybe shared realization of, you know, this idea that we had kind of relatively distant and separate communities was eroding because we were literally growing together. And through that, I think we realized that some of the previous divisions that maybe existed on, you know, a number of levels were not as significant as the things that united us. And I think that's generally true of many counties across the state that there's a lot of things that we all really do agree on, regardless of any other types of political or cultural differences.
From your perspective, what are the main issues that Summit Wasatch counties should collaborate on?
You know, obviously, we've been very successful in our transit coordination because regional transportation is a high priority for us. Right now, we're both in the same situation when it comes to affordable housing. Wasatch County is looking at making some improvements to our process, and Summit County started down that road a little bit. Their infrastructure needs, you know, our transportation network, UDOT is studying Highway 40 corridor that crosses between both of our counties. There's a lot of crossover, a lot of these same issues that we're all dealing with. We're kind of working together. State preemption, right? This SB 258 is just one of many ways in which the state is kind of eroding local control. And I think we're seeing a little bit of a pushback against that at the state level. So we're in a lot of the same boat.
Okay, moving on to the town of Independence. Some residents are asking to disincorporate, to no longer be a town. Does this come as a surprise to you?
Yeah, I was surprised to see it. So it was a little bit of a, you know, came out of nowhere, but we're kind of getting our arms around the concept of if this were to happen, how would it impact our community?
Yeah, I mean, this is Independence is and Hideout are the two examples of, I guess, the early preliminary municipalities. Again, it was like for a year and people could like petition the state to set up their own town. I guess it's like, is it backfiring? Is this a good example of what, you know, that should be pointed out to the state legislature?
I think it is a good example of the challenges that these towns face. You know, we have several small towns who face really significant challenges, and there are just so many things that are, when you become a town, you are the master of your own destiny, and with that comes a lot of responsibility and a lot of risks. And I think that's what you're seeing, at least some of the citizens in Independence acknowledge, is that there are risks associated with them wielding their own land use authority that if not managed carefully can end up with outcomes that maybe they didn't anticipate originally.
Right, because it's the developer, the property owner, that actually made the money and kind of just left the town to sort things out. I guess if their efforts are successful, what does this mean for Wasatch County? What additional services would the Wasatch County need to provide to Independence?
Well, Independence is a little different from Hideout in that I think there were many citizens that were involved in the process, and there has not been nearly the amount of development that Hideout has had. So Independence largely resembles, you know, many of the same things that it had when it was back in the county, maybe around 15 years ago or so. So what it would do is it would impact, you know, the property taxes of the people in the area. Their town property tax would be eliminated if they voted to dissolve the town. That would mean that the county has some responsibilities in terms of managing public roads, doing permitting and other types of approvals. But to whatever extent, there is also sales tax that generated in the town. And that's true of Daniel Summit, the gravel pits that they've approved and other things like that. That would be revenue that would help offset some of those costs. Figuring out exactly what the balance of those things are is still something that we're working on, and ultimately will only affect us if the citizens decide to go through with that dissolution.
Yeah. With just 75 registered voters, I think Independence is probably Wasatch County's smallest town. By contrast, Summit County's smallest town is Hennifer, which has about 800 people. Wallsburg, I think, also on the small side. Why does Wasatch County have so many towns that are so small?
You know, I was told that Independence was created to be independent, right? That was, they named themselves that because they wanted control of their destiny. And I think that's what you're seeing, even when there was the, you know, there's an ongoing process that I'm not exactly sure the status of, but the Riverview town, right? These were property owners and residents in the North Fields who wanted control of their own destiny. And I don't fault anyone for doing that. But what I think Independence is grappling with, and what I think every town grapples with, is the reality of managing your own destiny. it comes with a lot of complexity. It comes a lot with risks, and those are, so I don't know necessarily why there is maybe this difference in the number of small towns in Wasatch County. Interlochen is also a very small town. But I think it comes from that desire for local control, for local influence, and towns are the most local that you can have that influence and control.
Sure. All right, let's see. Later on the agenda, the council will hold a second reading of an ordinance to establish a finance department. You know, as some people pointed out, you know, is this government bureaucracy, or is such a department really needed, given that you've operated one without one for, you know, some of the biggest growth years?
Yeah, so I think it's helpful to address maybe some of the misconception there. While we are creating a new department, we are not hiring additional staff. What we're doing is we're reassigning two staff members who are currently part of the clerk auditor's office to an administrative department. I think we have navigated a lot of change over the last, you know, 2.5 decades as a council manager form of government. But what I think we're hoping to do is to continue to push the envelope of efficiency and effectiveness at the county level. And we think that this is one way in which we can do that. By having our finance division under an elected official, there is like an added layer of complexity. And I think the bureaucracy is actually being decreased by making this change. By allowing myself to work directly with our finance director, I think we're able to move more quickly as we make some of these improvements and best practices when it comes to, you know, how we manage our financial system or our financial transactions and accounting and reporting and making changes to those things.
All right. Construction underway for the county's new government building. What kind of progress have you made so far?
Yeah, we're actually at the point where we have poured the foundation, and in the next week or two, you should start to see vertical elements going up. The structure is primarily wood, and there are some steel elements. That was actually both a cost-saving measure and kind of an aesthetic priority, so it was less expensive than if we built a steel structure. So that'll go up actually pretty quick over the next month or two.
Okay. Any updates then to the construction cost or timeline?
No. Right now, we're actually ahead of budget. Very slightly, we have spent less percentage-wise than the total progress on the construction. So we're tracking on budget there. We finished our last project early and under budget. We're hoping for very much the same here. So we should be done by next fall.
All right. And the county recently completed a new access road for the Timber Lakes community. Why was this needed?
So Timber Lakes is a community that's been around for a very long time. And if it were a town, it probably would be one of our larger towns, but it's unincorporated. That community has for many years only had one main point of access. This is kind of on the northwest side of the county, or of the community, excuse me, that connects to Lake Creek Road. This road project was, you know, probably 2 decades, maybe more in effort to try and get a second point of access. So if for whatever reason there was an emergency at the front entrance of Timber Lakes, if there was a fire or an accident or some other kind of flood or blockage, there is this really great secondary access that goes through multiple property owners. There are multiple gates on it. It, you know, it's not always open to the public, but it is an emergency access that provides a safe egress into the forest.
Okay. Dustin, anything else you wanted to mention?
No, not today.
All right. Appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 8:31. Coming up now on 8:32. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. On Thursday, Park City Film presents, as part of its Raising Voices and Made in Utah series, the feature-length documentary Ashima. Joining me on the phone now to tell us more about his film is director Kenji Tsukamoto. Good morning, Kenji. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Did I pronounce her name right?
Yeah. Ashima or Ashima. She goes by both.
Okay. First, tell us a little bit about yourself and career and a bit about your film.
Yeah. So I was born in Japan, and then I came to the U.S. at the age of 8. I've kind of lived all over the U.S., but ended up settling here in Utah 2003, I think it was. is a film. I got into it kind of accidentally when I had a cousin that kind of went through a quarter-life crisis. And he went from being an English teacher to studying film in grad school. And it kind of opened up my world of possibilities that, that filmmaking could be a career.
Okay, so I mentioned this is your first feature-length documentary, I believe. You've made other films as well?
Made short films, a couple, but nothing to this scale. This was something that I kind of dove headfirst into shortly after graduating college, and it's taken me over a decade to complete.
Wow. All right, so tell us a little bit about how you met Ashima and what it was about her and her story that made you want to spend, again, a decade making the film.
Oh, met Ashima. Well, first, it was a coworker, like a boss of mine, that had introduced Ashima to me, just she existed. I'm not a rock climber. I don't know much about climbing, but I returned to Utah from living in Japan in 2009. I served an LDS mission there. I saw a lot of, you know, at the time, Japan was struggling with a really high youth suicide rate and something known as hikikomori, which is where kids would isolate themselves from society, literally locking themselves in their room for years, sometimes decades. I came back to Utah. I really wanted to do something to shed light on this. First, I was thinking about doing a documentary on that particular social issue. And the more I thought about it, the more I looked into it, I really wanted young kids to have a positive role model. And that's when my boss introduced me, or let me know about who Ashima was. I watched a couple videos, read a New York Times article, ended up just looking their name up in the New York City phone book, just kind of calling until I called the right Daishi family. And it turned out that I was born in the same small town in Japan as Ashima's mother. I've hit it off with that family. They invited me to come visit them over Thanksgiving break. And I spent a week with them and I told them my experience of what I saw in Japan, what my goals were. They agreed to participate. I quit my job, and I ended up in the next several years living with them.
Okay. And how old was she when you started filming, and how old is she now?
I think she was 11, 12, around that age. She is now 25.
And I guess what did you see in her that kind of went beyond her, you know, extraordinary climbing ability?
I think I related a lot. I saw a lot of myself in Ashima, not in the climbing aspect, but I mean, growing up, when I first came to the States, my family moved every couple years. I always felt between multiple worlds of trying to assimilate in the States. And with Ashima, she was this young girl that was more comfortable around like grown men in their 30s, because that's the level that she climbed at. And she struggled kind of struggled being at school. Then also at home, you know, her parents had her in their 50s and she's an only child. She's very comfortable being around adults. And then balancing out being at home with parents that only speak Japanese, trying to fit in elsewhere in New York City. Also, as I got to know Ashima, you know, a lot of people assume that Ashima came from a very wealthy family because she lives in New York City. And her parents were both, you know, like struggling artists. And I wanted to show this sort of Ashima that people didn't get to see on social media or through climbing magazines, how smart she was and how hard she worked. Her daily routine was crazy. I mean, she'd go to school and go straight from school to the climbing gym till 9-10 o'clock at night, then come home, would do homework till like midnight, 1 o'clock, and then just repeat that every day. I wanted people to see beyond the social media posts that they'd see from Ashima.
Yeah, and I, you know, and that's certainly, there are moments of the film when she seems to be carrying these enormous expectations for somebody so young. Did you worry about the pressure that she was under, or maybe have put herself under?
Yeah, it's a tremendous amount of pressure. And I think as during the time that I was with her, you know, she really just loves climbing. If she had to go a day or two without it, it kind of, I think, irritated her. I think luckily she was able to focus on the positive aspects of just the love of the sport. I think competitions is where I think things weighed more heavily. And of course, like, I was just a silent observer, so I can't tell you what was going on exactly in her mind. But as she got older, I know the pressure, I think, built and built. And now I stopped filming with her when she was around 14, 15. I think more intense moments of her life came after.
Yeah, how good is she compared to the likes of, say, a Lynn Hill or more recently the Jonja Garnbrets of the world?
I mean, Ashima, we can like never really tell through competitions because Ashima doesn't really compete anymore, but she's pretty elite. Like, the youngest person to climb various grades of bouldering. One of the few people that's always climbing, at least when she was in her early teens, was climbing grades, boulder grades that are higher than her age. And I think now she has a more balanced approach in life where she did take time to go to UCLA for a year, is really interested in geology and agriculture and is taking a lot of time to volunteer wolfing at different farms and getting to experience life beyond climbing. So I think she's still, you know, high up there, elite athlete, but also has a more balanced life.
Yeah. And you say you're not a climber, but how is it that you then got the footage of climbing these amazing steep feats?
Well, most of the film is bouldering, so not too high off the ground where I could, you know, climb up a hill or up a rock nearby and set up a tripod. There were a couple times where she did sport climb where there were static lines already placed for photographers and filmmakers and to kind of learn how to bend on those ropes. And luckily the folks at Petzl here in Utah gave me a crash course and gave me some gear to help prepare me for that.
Yeah, and what are some of the other kind of lessons that making this film teach you about documentary filmmaking that you probably didn't know when you started?
I think the biggest thing is like the lack of support for the arts, especially when it comes to documentaries in the States. Most other countries throughout the world have a fund that's set up by the government because they see value in capturing real stories in their culture. But that's been a rude awakening. Like I think I maxed out 5-6 credit cards and took out 2 personal loans to fund this documentary.
Oh, wow. So it sounds like you've had some success, though, with some awards, but the awards don't come with any money to kind of pay off the debt?
They might come with like a couple $100 to maybe $1,000. Definitely spent way more than that on the film. We actually launched the Kickstarter today to help spread word about us doing our own independent distribution. We're going to start playing in theaters, starting with Park City this Thursday, and then we're going to various states and other places throughout fall and winter to try to recoup some costs and raise advertise for the film, I guess.
Okay, so why is Park City a good place then for this film to be seen? I know we got lots of climbers here.
I mean, Park City means a lot to me. I've ever since I moved to Utah, I've been going to Sundance, so over 20 years, and it's really broadened my worldview. Allowed me to meet collaborators that I worked on with Ashima even before I was pursuing this documentary. I think transitioning from film festivals to theatrical screening, starting off with Park City, means the world to me.
All right. Has Ashima attended any of the screenings with you?
Yeah, we had our world premiere at a festival called Doc NYC, which is the largest documentary film festival in America. And Ashima and her parents, luckily it's in New York, so they could just walk from their home to the premiere. And we had sold out screening. And for them, it was their first time watching the film, or Ashima's parents, it was their first time watching the film. And luckily they loved it. It's a pretty honest look into their private lives. So I'm glad they could appreciate it for what it was.
Okay, anything else you want to tell us about the film?
Oh, I hope people come out to watch it, and I'll be there to answer questions after the screening.
Okay. Hey, appreciate your time, Kenji. And good
luck. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Kenji Tsukamoto, again, is the director of the feature-length documentary Ashima. It will be screened this Thursday, August 20th, 7 p.m. at the Jim Santee Auditorium. And as Kenji mentioned, he will be around for a post-film Q&A. KPCW News Time now, 8:42. It's 8:42. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, after hearing from residents, the Heber City Council poised to vote on a proposed 4.8% tax increase at its meeting tonight. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has more.
Heber City is considering raising property taxes in response to inflation. At a public hearing August 5th, city leaders heard from more than a dozen residents who say they're struggling to make ends meet and don't want a higher tax bill. Now it's time for the council to make its decision. If the full proposed increase is approved, a resident would pay an extra $17 a year for a home worth $850,000. A business worth the same amount would pay an additional $31 annually. Heber would collect an extra $174,000 for a total general fund budget of $18.9 million. The council could also approve a smaller tax increase or decline to raise taxes at all, as Finance Director Sarah Nagel explains.
If council chooses to not move forward with an increase or reduce the increase, we will ask each department head to go back and reduce this amount from their current operating budgets.
Heber last raised taxes in August 2024 by a little over 9%. The city council meeting begins at 6 p.m. Tuesday at 75 North Main Street in Heber. For the agenda and a link to attend online, visit kpcw.org. Heber City is a financial supporter of KPCW. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
8:44 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour, and in studio with me with an update from Recycle Utah and a preview of some upcoming events, we've got Recycle Utah Executive Director Andy Heck. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so the 11th annual 100-mile meal happening Saturday. Any tickets left?
There are 18 tickets left as of yesterday. Get them. I know there are more than 18 people out there that are expecting to be able to get tickets.
Okay. Now, this is for the full dinner. That is basically, I mean, what the name of the dinner is. Everything must come from within 100 miles. So,
so unique. What a great culinary experience. We're happy enough to get a grant from the Summit County Restaurant Tax to advertise this a little bit better, because when you take a step back and really look at a 100-mile meal, all the food is sourced within 100 miles. 11 years of farm-to-table local in our community. This is a culinary destination experience, so we were able to open up our advertising a little bit more broadly than just our immediate community here, and that was pretty neat.
Okay, and you're also offering something that hasn't been done that I know of for a $100 ticket. Others can join in. You won't get dinner, but what? You'll get a couple of drinks?
So we did have to pivot on that. We weren't seeing money ticket sales, and we didn't want to force it. We reached out to a few people and said, hey, come to the 100-mile meal. This is a great event. So we're sticking with the 100-mile meal.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Recycle Utah, of course, more than just a place to drop off recyclables. Talk about some of the other events and programs coming up.
Yeah. I want to start off with a big shout out. We had a very successful summer camp program. Part of our education programs that we run, I think, are very undertold in our community, the impact and how much we interact with these kids. 700 kids at summer camps this summer were interacted with our director of education, Chelsea. She did an amazing job. And then we have, Hazmat Day. I've been saying this for a couple of months now. Hazmat Day is October 8th through 10th. And then Dumpster Day is coming up September 26th.
Okay. Always good to remind us about those so we can get them on our calendar. Let's talk a little bit about what you call the warehouse. It's getting a revamp. It's basically your version of a thrift store.
Yeah. And I refer to the thrift store because when I say the warehouse, I get a little confused. So we'll straighten that out, I'm sure. That is an area of Recycle Utah where people can bring lightly used everything from dishwashers, small appliances, countertops, light bulbs, light fixtures, tables, chairs, desks, just slightly used housing goods. We resell them. So it's a thrift store. We're putting a little effort into revamping this. And it is amazing what the possibilities are. In fact, we just partnered with, we were allowed to partner with the University of Utah Goff Strategic Leadership Institute, and they are starting a semester-long project on doing a deep dive analysis on what we really can expect out of that thrift store. That helps us determine square footage at our new facility, how much emphasis we don't want to do it too big. We don't want to go too small. We want to make sure that we are offering the right service here. And I think there's a lot of opportunity in the thrift store at Recycle Utah. Already we've seen some improvements. We've seen some return on just putting some effort there. So if you're hearing this, come on down, take a look.
Okay. How is it different, say, than what you might find at the Restore or, you know, just some of the other thrift stores in town?
Yeah, we definitely want to differentiate ourselves from the others. We don't feel that we want to create competition in the space. The Recycle Utah has a little bit of a different feel, and we are defining that. So we eliminate a lot of the overlap with the other thrift stores. And I think we have a good delineation, and maybe next month I'll have better words to speak to that. But it's a good thrift experience.
Okay. How are things moving forward with the new center?
So well. It is going very quickly right now. We have some drawings that we're going to release at 100 Mile Meal. These are really exciting. So much work has gone into these. We have our entire board. We have different committees working on different aspects of design, operations. Chelsea, Josh, our operations director, and myself just went to a trip to Colorado, looked at four different facilities very similar to ours to make sure that our design and our flows and our thoughts are aligned and we're not missing anything. We came back with a great report on what we saw. Our designs are getting pretty close to being finalized. In fact, yesterday we just hired a general contractor for our project for pre-construction services. That's a big moment in time. We are moving forward. We're getting close to being ready to submit.
Yeah. So that's what I was going to ask. When do you expect to submit the application to Snyderville Basin Planning Commission?
I don't know officially. I have someone that's working very closely with us who'll be doing that submittal process, and I don't want to take a guess without knowing. But I know that we're talking about what documents we need, so very soon.
Yeah. And, you know, when this all started, you were going to be out of there by now.
Yeah.
So what would have happened?
Well, we would have been in trouble. So when I started earlier this year, the beginning of the year, the original date was September of this year. And working very closely with the city, who owns the property we're on right now, they own Woodbine Way. They've been very generous in letting Recycle Utah use that property. And I reached out and said, hey, can we have till March? And they said yes, and that was definitely a drop-dead date. So March, we knew for a long time that March was going to be the official date. And that gives us the time to figure out how to construct a temporary facility on our new property. So that's everything we're doing right now. Like I said, we put so much energy into designing and construction, but it's the phasing of the construction approach that is now front and center. And that phasing goes around a temporary facility on that property. So this town has awesome behavior around recycling. People who come to Recycle Utah, same great everything you do, just change the GPS coordinates come April 1st.
Yeah, but you still need approval for even a temporary facility, no?
We do. There is a temporary approval process. We work closely with the planning committee, the planning department at Summit County. They've been incredibly helpful. Big shout out to Peter and Jennifer over there. And we've gone through the steps of what a temporary use permit looks like, what the application looks like, and we're pretty confident that we're moving in the right direction to have a temporary facility up. So everything we're doing right now is designed around not closing. We will remain open.
Okay. So a temporary facility would look like what? A concrete pad with dumpsters on it and some kind of shelter?
Yep, exactly. It's no frills, bare bones. You know, depending on how much square footage we're looking at, we're hoping to get about 7,000 square feet. That would allow us to run our baler, so we still could bale items. Otherwise, it gets a little bit more expensive. A few roll-offs for what you see right now, just replicated over there. And that would maintain continuity of our current operations while we finish the building process for our new facility.
Okay. Hey, a while back I had sent you an article that I had seen about the single-use plastic bag versus cloth bag debate. It was from the Danish Environmental Protection Agency, which had run the full life cycle numbers, basically saying that an organic cotton tote bag has to replace 20,000 plastic bags to break even on every environmental measure that they tracked, and 7,100 uses just to match the climate impact alone. This is because of the hidden cost of the water and the land that it takes to grow the cotton to make the bag. And then it went on to say that you'd have to carry that same bag to the store almost every day for 20 years before it earned back its fruit footprint. I guess it's like, so are we doing the wrong thing with our cotton totes? I mean, because as you know, we either lose them or they get lost or they end up a closet before the, 7,100 uses.
Yeah, I love these types of studies, the life cycle analysis of things, really thinking through what is beneficial and what isn't. And a lot of times we do expect things to be beneficial, which might not be. And for most of us, including myself, we don't have the information to dig deep on this. And when you look at these types of studies, there's so many different angles you can come from. Looking at, okay, well, cotton is compostable, so where does it go at the end? I fully am worried about plastics overall. And unfortunately, the cotton tote bag, I lump that in with reusable water bottles. They've become a little bit more of a walking billboard for us. And sometimes they're being mass produced and we don't need any more of these. But the idea to understand where things come from, how they're used, and where they go in every day, everything you touch, if you can have that superpower, I think we would learn a lot more about, I don't want to say necessarily right and wrong, but the benefits and all the ins and outs of what you're thinking is good. You refocus on that. So I'm really happy for that study to come out and actually be talking about things like this because it's very tricky.
Yeah, because that study did show that the plain plastic bag carried the lowest production footprint of the bags tested. It weighs almost nothing. It uses so little material that making it costs less than making the canvas alternative. So I guess it just begs the question, should we ask for plastic at the store?
Well, I mean, one more thing I'd put on that is the plastic is so small. When it goes into our landfill, it gets completely crushed. There's also options for that plastic bag to go to waste to energy. I know burning isn't great, but we all drive on concrete, and concrete does have to have heat to make it. That heat can come from natural gas. That heat can come from burning plastics. Yes, they burn the plastics in a very clean environment, but it's still producing CO2, and we have to do that for concrete. I wouldn't want to say that, oh, yeah, you should ask for plastic or paper. The best thing is whatever is being reused. You know, if you have, you already have the cotton tote bags in your closet. I know I have plenty, and I make sure that I always have them in my car. So, oh, I'm on my way home. I'm going to swing by the grocery store. I know I have a bag that I can use. I don't even have to ask for anything. So I think what I'm building around is whatever you don't have to ask for, I think is probably the best option.
Okay, and if you've got a closet full of bags or water bottles, just walk on by when they're offering more.
Walk on by, yep.
Okay, Andy, anything else you want to mention?
Just a big thank you to everyone who's been working on everything we're doing. We have so much going on with this new facility. 21,000 square foot warehouse, 5,000 square feet of front office space. We've got this really neat idea of what Recycle Utah is going to become and who we will be in the next few years. We'll have greater impact of what we do in Summit County, and it's leaning into the goals that Summit County has stated about reducing waste to the landfill and diverting more material away. And we're really excited, and I just want to thank everyone who's been putting in such hard work into this whole masterpiece we're putting together.
Okay, well, we're going to have to wait till next month then to find out more about specific plans, huh?
You can always take a look at our website, recycleutah.org. We've got a Q&A page. We've got We got a new volunteer sign-up page. If you want to volunteer at Recycle Utah, go to our page. You can select shifts right from our webpage now. But always stay up to date with recycleutah.org. Get our email newsletter and know what's going on.
Okay. Andy Heck is Executive Director of Recycle Utah. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Leslie.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW News Time now, 8:58.